Changing your relationship with your phone is actually easier than you think. And I know that because I've done it. As most of you know, I left Instagram in 2025, which was supposed to be forever, but it turned out to just be 6 months. And the reason I left was so that I could understand on a much deeper level what was happening in my body, you know, with my attention and my mind and my phone. And during that time, I went deep into the research, the psychology, the neuroscience, the nervous system regulation aspects of it. And I started to ask the real questions I had. Why did my phone create resentment? Why did I feel powerless in relationship to my phone and social media? And why did I feel anxious even when I wasn't using it? And why did just using it less never actually work? There was something deeper that I need to understand. And what I found surprised me. It turns out that there are very real biological and psychological reasons our relationship with our phones feels so charged. And it goes beyond just dopamine loops or willpower. And here's the most important part. Once you understand what's really happening, changing your relationship with your phone stops feeling like a fight. It actually becomes pretty practical and it feels very grounded. Now, on January 4th, I'm going to be teaching you everything I've learned. I'm running a live workshop on how to reclaim your attention and rebuild a healthy relationship with social media and your smartphone without having to give it up and without swimming in shame. I'm going to be sharing the most profound insights I gained during that six-month break, things I've never shared before, along with simple tools that you could just apply immediately once you're done the workshop, tools that will work with your nervous system, not against it. And if you want 2026 to be the year you're the most present, most focused you've ever been, and more available to your actual life while still using your phone intentionally, this workshop is for you. You can learn more and register at createthelove.com/reclaim. That's on January 4th. I can't wait to see you there.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Mark Gross Podcast. Today, I'm so excited to be joined by Monica Guzman. I'm very excited for this conversation because in a world of divided times, which I'm sure, you know, families and cultures have always had oppositional views and division, etc. But it seems that we are in the perfect storm of technology meets short form content meets delicate, important conversations that really matter to all of us. Yeah. And also the moralization of everything. And so Monica is the author of I Never Thought of It That Way. And when I heard about Monica from my good friend and our good friend, Ali Selman, I couldn't help. I couldn't wait to have a conversation with you. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It is such an important time to learn the skills of being open and curious to different perspectives. Mm-hmm. I think that we can easily not do that. We can easily never have to face that. And I would say in a lot of ways, it's also kind of celebrated or seen as strong to just dismiss your family or your friends who have a different political or ideological perspective. And I'm always brought back to a quote from that I heard Jonathan Haidt say that when we start with two perspectives, there's a third one that becomes present and it's seemingly wiser than the first two. And so I'm really excited to hear your lived experience of this and why it was so important. So where do we begin in this?
I think that the most important place to build the skill of having curiosity and aiming it at the things we don't understand or that are sometimes a little bit dark to us, honestly, is within. Most of the kind of suffering from our divisions comes from a lack of seeing. And the question is, what is it that we're missing? What are you missing? So in a way, that's the key question. That's the question that can transform certainty into curiosity, that allows us to gain a little bit of humility. Because in any given moment, we are all dead wrong about something. We just don't know what it is. And the question becomes, do you want to find out sooner or later? With the way that the divides have put us all into silos, we're caught in this vicious cycle where we're judging each other more while we're engaging each other less. And if you fast forward that movie, judging each other more, engaging each other less, what are our judgments based on? They're not based on actual interaction with other people. they're mostly based on the conversation we have with ourselves, informed by the signals we get from our media and from people who share our points of view. And the people who share our points of view are increasingly judgmental of people who don't. And we know from the research on opinion that opinions tend to radicalize. When you share your instincts, you'll share your blind spots too. So we will be wrong about more things when it comes to other people and their perspectives. So I often think to myself, how can we pretend to be informed when we're not informed about each other? The most powerful thing in this world is not an event. It's people. We're the agents. So if we don't understand each other, we don't understand our world. And then we don't really understand ourselves because we're relational and social to begin with. So it's this whole cycle from the internal to the external, right? From the individual to the kind of close circle to society and all the way back. It all is functioning in a loop. And we have so much incentive to just stay close in. It's more comfortable. It is less scary in a scary time. It is less anxiety inducing. So for me, it's we don't need to judge ourselves or each other for what we can't do, who we can't talk to, what we can't talk about right now. But what I think we really ought to invite ourselves to do is to build the capacity. Build the capacity to do more. Build the capacity to do what we can. Work on that skill. Find your edge. Push it wherever it happens to be.
Why do you think that starting with ourselves seems to actually be the most confronting part?
I do think that's the hardest part. I think it's because we don't tend to acknowledge the assumptions that we carry about our world and how we ought to interact with it. But those become the biggest barriers to building capacity to get curious about anybody different. For example, I know that sometimes folks say, you know, I can't, they imagine themselves with somebody else, somebody who disagrees with them on something really important. And an assumption they might carry within them is if they oppose what I support, they must hate what I love, which makes them feel threatened on the level of values, which may lead to another assumption that also can be independently generated, which is basically, if they don't change, I'm not okay.
Yeah.
That one's so really true. Big, right? Because as my friend Luis Mojica, he's a somatic therapist, and he speaks beautifully on this point that, you know, two people in a room with very different ideas, what's happening in that room? There's two people in a room with very different ideas. But the body, the sense of emotional activation is operating more like there's danger. There's actual danger. Why? And that's because of all the history that we come in with, all the stories we tell ourselves about whatever that opposing idea is and what it represents and what our obligations are and what our identity is and what we ought to do and how people would judge us for how we would behave in this conversation. And if I don't stand up for my side, if I stand up for real, and all these things add up to, oh my gosh, no, that person is a monster. I will be a monster if I'm here. I will be a monster if I get curious about them, if I allow them to talk about their beliefs and their beliefs are unsavory. What kind of a person am I? There's a wonderful thinker and podcaster named Dylan Marin, I think, is that his name? And he says, engagement is not endorsement. Engagement is not endorsement. But that's another assumption many of us carry. That if I have a conversation with someone and they happen to say what they believe and what they believe is something I find terrible, then I'm now at fault somehow.
Yeah, that has become such a, I would say, a speaking point more of progressives. I can't platform you. I can't platform your voice. And what ends up being challenging about that is ideas. Of course, I understand that language can lead to dehumanization. I can understand that ideas can lead to dehumanization. But the righteous throne of not being open to any dialogue or discussion is the same rigidity.
Yes.
It's dangerous, but it's marred in righteousness. And that's what's so hard to sort of participate in or to even engage with, because all of a sudden it's like, well, even if you engage with that idea, you're a bad person.
Right, right. And what we don't see is that often the things we do out of love become hate. That there is a kind of dehumanization.
Very interesting.
And a rigid refusal to listen to a person. Now, there are contexts where it can be very practical not to listen to certain things. And everybody has their edge, like I said, and we should not be judging each other for what we can't do, right? Like, I have a friend who is the parent of a trans child and not capable, not interested of having that argument with certain people. That's fine. There's nothing, this is not about judging those places, right? I think that the trap we really find ourselves in is everyone left and right wants to live in a good world. Everyone left and right wants to make the best decisions and have those decisions upheld by everybody else. And we keep missing the ways that people who have different points of view define what a good world is and how to get to it. And everybody has things that, it's like love and hate get crossed, get mixed. But because we don't have the conversation, we don't give ourselves the chance to actually hear from each other where the nuance really is. There is so much less actual division than we think on the actual substance issues that are challenging us. Yeah, and like research keeps showing us this, that mostly the degree of difference is up here in our minds. It's in our imaginations. And again, it's amplified and reified by a media landscape that is incentivized to reach toward scandal. You know, turn the volume way up on conflict for obvious reasons. We all know this is the way the attention economy works. It tugs on our emotions, and our emotions want to feel activated, right? We get the dopamine hits when we think like they're coming after us and that kind of thing. And which is not to say that it's not sometimes true, but it's never, ever what it looks like. So what is the primary source? How do you find out what's really going on? Well, you have to get close enough to people. But if you think that they are hateful and therefore you don't listen to them, you end up perpetuating the cycles of blindness that are going to cause more reactionary policies that are unwise for all of us, for all of us. So we have, something's got to give. And I think what that mainly is that each of us has to find our edge and push it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's what you were speaking about before, beginning with ourselves. I was reflecting on recently that if you can't explore your own contradictions, you'll die under the weight of them. Like, I wouldn't be able to hold oppositional views if I can't just be honest that I have them within me, that I say I believe something and I do something, or I, you know, it's like when you look at the data on activism, there's some really interesting research on harmonious passions versus obsessive passions. And it's by a researcher at University of Montreal, I think. And anyways, what was interesting is the people who have a sort of radical relationship to the environment versus people who have a harmonious relationship in terms of saving the environment and protecting it. The people who have more of obsessive passion are less likely to recycle. And they're more likely to commit a terrorist act. So there's something strangely sort of inconsistent that happens. And I've thought a lot about this because I think in a culture that has given power to victimization, which is important to empower victims, but there's a delicate line where all of a sudden we'll seek victimization to get power. And we'll put ourselves in positions where we are in order to, you know, be able to have a voice, which I understand from a survival-based perspective. Eventually, sort of there's an inconsistency that happens even in the presenting as virtuous.
Yes.
That willingness to see my own inconsistencies and to see, you know, when I think about the different perspectives that have been held over so many ideas, like I think of your friend who has a trans kid, obviously that subject is very stressful for people. It makes a lot of sense. And when you actually get into the nuance of that conversation, which I'm very interested in, the like curious space that lives between, I'm afraid that if I have this conversation, my child won't feel accepted in the world. And, you know, and then there's the other end of that, which is there are other pathologies that create it, maybe not just spiritual, multiple souls, all that kind of stuff. Of course there are. And I can understand that to one person, they're afraid their child will end up feeling confused because and get an idea that was never there, or that the trauma won't be explored that's at the core pathology of the rejection of a gender, etc. Versus like, I'm afraid that my child will unalive themselves because they don't, like, what, talk about two very legitimate fears. And if we can't actually name those and somehow learn how, because I think the fear that lives within both of those thought processes lives within both people.
Yes.
Definitely. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely. Definitely. No, I'm really glad you brought up fear, because the longer I do this work and have these conversations, the more I just keep finding fear under every rock.
Mm.
That I started off talking about certainty as the archvillain of curiosity. That if you can't, if you think you know, you'll never think to ask. Why ask? You think you know. You know, there's no gap in your mind neurologically. Your question won't even get formulated, let alone posed, right? And then you'll believe assumptions, and assumptions are answers to questions you never bothered to ask. But fear, you know, fear is also extremely corrosive to curiosity, because you can't wonder about something you think is out to get you. Okay, so where do we, which makes sense, right? If a big bear is chasing me, I'm not going to be like, how fuzzy is it? I want to run away. Like, this is, we're all descendants of people who were smart enough to be afraid when it mattered, right? That's great. Fear saves us. There's a quote that I've never been able to trace to the origin, but I carry it with me about fear, which is, don't waste your fear on anything but danger. And I think that's the line.
So simple, but so good.
Right. So you know, you named in your example two powerful fears that would get right to the core of people's love and people's care for each other. And when we're quite afraid, neurologically, our cognitive resources move towards survival. You know, the trauma responses, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, they move away from the places in our brain that help us reflect, gather more information. There's a sense of urgency to get out, to do what is necessary. And that's all well and good when we're being chased by a bear. It's actually really, really, really bad when there's more to learn and it's a bigger thing than we immediately realize. But the more afraid we are of the potential consequences, the more quickly we want to move to a solution, the more we need to get to certainty, the more uncomfortable it is to even hold the hot potato of uncertainty, then we will act out of fear. And it might be undue fear. It might be uninformed fear, right? And I want to be really careful here, because fear does save us. And there are things to be afraid of. And there are people who are so consumed by hate that they are worth fearing. We can't be non-vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
But again, all I see is research that shows that we keep imagining things to be worse than they are. We keep imagining other people to believe more extreme things than they do. We keep imagining that there are more of those people than there truly are. And we have a media ecosystem, again, that like tends to amplify the stuff that sounds the most radical.
Totally.
Is it true? Is it true the way it's expressing it? Is it true in tone? Because it's the tone that speaks to our fear, not the facts, the tone. The tone wakes up our fear. So if we're constantly living in places that affirm our fears, soothe our fears, but not by challenging them ever or questioning them ever, then what I'm afraid of is that we're actually creating more fear for ourselves.
Mm.
We are living in a scarier world than we need to. So people tell me sometimes, there's so much emotional labor in what you're talking about in talking to somebody across the divide. And again, I want to say again, there's always the red lines for different people, you know, that's fine. But there's an emotional labor in not talking to people who disagree with you and realizing the truth.
Yeah, true.
There's, if the truth is not as bad as what you imagine, there's an incentive to de-escalate your fear by learning what's really there in someone else's heart. I think about, I'm a journalist too, right? So truth matters deeply to me. And the last many years, there's been a big conversation about misinformation, misinformation about facts, about events. But I also worry about the misinformation about what's in people's hearts. There's a lot of misinformation out there about what's in people's hearts,
true.
About what motivates people to believe what they believe. But we don't tend to question that misinformation.
Yeah, the ways that humans have evolved to just make assumptions, to sort of shorten the labor or energy required to understand someone else's perspective. Like if I see, you know, 100 people running in the opposite direction, it makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. I'll start running before I ask questions. I can get to the question, but it makes sense that I would follow them first. Yeah. Yes. And when I read Jonathan Haidt's book, Coddling of the American Mind, so much stuff started to make sense to me, because otherwise it just felt very weird that people couldn't have these conversations and any nuance was labeled something, you know, some sort of trope or word. It made it so then we didn't have any more conversations because everyone was afraid of being titled something.
Exactly.
And I think the onslaught of developing brains meeting technology and social media, we have just, it's, as I said at the beginning, a perfect storm.
Yeah.
And what I see now is that the only way really back, well, that's probably a little finite, but it feels like it's true, is that we have to be able to build longer dinner tables. We have to sit down with people we disagree with. I think that's the real work, because you have a really good friend who said to me, he's always that, he doesn't really use social media at all. So he's like free from all those thought processes. Both his parents were teachers. He's just like the sweetest guy. And he said to me, you know, if we break bread with people, we won't hate them.
Yeah.
Like if you sit down and have dinner, but we've almost like made it a badge of honor.
Yeah.
And recently I was listening to a psychologist talk about this conversation about, hey, you know, at Thanksgiving, like you don't just grit and bear it at Thanksgiving dinner when you're family member's perspective is rooted in bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that is so binary, mm-hmm. because I know people who vote in every direction and they're all good people.
Yeah.
And when I hear a psychologist giving that view, which his perspective clearly is obvious about how he feels about a certain political group. Yep. And then anyone who thinks about or associates or votes in that direction is immediately a bigot.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, like if you really get to the core fear that someone has that votes in any direction and got to understand it, we'd see that we're generally oscillating around similar values. We're just doing it differently.
That's right.
And the way we think we're going to get that thing that we need, whether that's social services or money because we have more pro-financial entrepreneurship policy, whatever it is, it's so much more complex than if you vote that way, you're a bigot. And if you vote that way, you're a progressive sheep.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like hard in my body. I just like when I heard, who I really respect as therapist, but I was also like, ah, no, like you're perpetuating the same thing. So I'm curious, where was your origin story of even doing this work? Because it had to be unpopular at first. I mean, obviously your book's done incredibly well, but I just mean what you're advocating for causes people to be afraid, because we all know that we are not being curious and open-minded.
Yeah, we do. I've met people from extremities of all sides, and yes, they all agree with that.
Yeah.
Like, that should be a starting point, you know? We all know what we lack, and we all know what we need to build. So can we focus on that conversation? So it started for me through two paths, one my personal life and one my professional life. So the professional life, as I mentioned, I'm a journalist. That's what I've done my whole career. And I started off really shy, but realized how effing fascinating people are when you start asking them questions, and especially when you find out what moves them and what they love, and they light up, because everybody wants to be understood and everybody wants those things seen that they most value. And boy, I got hooked. And I also learned how ridiculously easy it is to get people wrong.
Mm.
And I, you know, I have a bunch of really hard memories, including at a small newsroom in Michigan, somebody coming in and just telling me how wrong I got them in a story. You know, I wasn't in a big city building. I could be far away from everything. And to know how easily I can hurt people by misrepresenting them to their community, the power that I had as a journalist, even in a small town. I mean, that's a lot of power. And what I realized was we all have that power to get people right or wrong. And there's a duty. I find it like a responsibility I do in my entire life to try not to do that to people, try to get people right. And of course, that's only gotten harder. And over the years, I noticed that what I wanted to do in journalism was help people understand each other. I sort of saw how all the pieces fit. And I said, okay, you know, in a democratic republic, like, journalism comes in as the fourth estate. We tell the stories. We try to get to truth. We try to be responsible. And it all works, right? It all hooks into everything else so that everybody's informed. And here we go. And we understand each other. But boy, the last X number of years, media has not really been that piece, because it's not being trusted. People are choosing their own flavor of media, and they're all opposed to each other. So if I'm telling a story in one kind of outlet, I'll reach these people, but not those people. In fact, those people will think the opposite of what I'm saying. And that can't help us understand each other. So I figured, I got to get out of journalism. I got to go a level deeper. I got to figure out what's going on. Meanwhile, the personal thing. So I'm a Mexican immigrant, and my parents moved us from Mexico when I was like five or six. And in the year 2000, we became citizens. They went Republican and I went Democrat. And we were so diametrically opposed. I was shocked. I was 17 when I was naturalized after they took the citizenship test, and like immediately a Republican campaign sign went up. And I'm like, huh? What? You know, I was just this befuddled teenager who couldn't believe it. And then everything started to click. You know, hilarity ensued over years. We're a very unfiltered family. A lot of Latino stereotypes apply. We just like yell at restaurants in Spanish, you know. Growing up in New Hampshire, very few people understood us. So we could just jam on and on. Fill up the hot air in the car, front seat versus the back seat. Lots of arguments. And then when the 2016 campaign came along, things really intensified, like they did with so many families. And looking back, I didn't see it at the time, but mostly the aghastness came from me about their political choice in that election. And that became a real trial for us and for me, because here I am, someone who believes that it's important not to get people wrong, someone who knows how easy that is, someone who grew out of shyness by experiencing how wonderful it can be to understand people on their own terms. And then here are my parents.
Yeah.
Okay, can we do this?
Yeah, this is like, roll your sleeves up, because this is the deepest. I mean, this is the deepest personal work, no matter what, anyways. But you sprinkle a little politics in there too, like not enough just general family dysfunction. Like, we're going to add in diametrically opposed, which what you're saying, I just want to name before you keep going, which is that this is the story of so many families.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's sad.
And I've connected and heard from so many. Yeah. And the ingredients are all different. And I'm always mindful of, it's not about, you know, I'm better, and so I could keep my relationship just fine. And I guess you're worse because your relationship didn't stay fine. So something's wrong with you. It's like, that is such BS. That is not it. The dynamics, histories, the roots we all carry that inform our opinions, the relationships over years and decades with each other, what we expect of each other in families, all of that, it's way too much for anyone to try to unpack and make some kind of problem to solve. You know, if we just move the X variable over here and then I say this and that, well, everything will be fine. No, it's a complete black box. It's very, very difficult. Right. All you can control is yourself, you know, your behavior, your attitude, but results are not guaranteed.
Right.
You cannot control other people. What happened with me was, for all the variables I couldn't see, for all the black box stuff that was going on, somehow me and my parents were able to have really hard conversations, totally unfiltered, as they always were. Lots of tears, lots of yelling. But we kept it to a simmer. If things burned, somehow we were able to cool it down before it burned too much, before it burned us, you know? What was amazing about that was, I came to understand them, and they came to understand me, because they were confused too. They weren't as anxious about it, but they were also like, why not? Like, what's going on? So that was amazing, and it was revealing. And when I compared and contrasted my experience with the experience of folks around me, and when I compared and contrasted how I viewed folks who across the aisle from me with how many of my friends in Seattle viewed folks across the aisle from them, I thought, oh my gosh. You know, because there was so much labeling, there was so much stereotyping, there was so much flattening, there was so much lack of lack of knowledge that can only come from really wrestling with something with somebody. You know, like we've gotten to a point in our society where we're talking about people, but not with them. And I think that's like a short way of saying, like, this is how we get out, is you think about the people you talk about, but never with, and you go talk with them.
Right.
You know, you
go, which is easier said than done. You
humanize them. Yeah, way easier said than done. Exactly. It's what we need to do, because the humanized part, it's not just a nice to have. It's not a sidebar. If we don't enter, if enough of us don't enter into genuine, candid conversations about these hard things with each other, seeing ourselves as human, we're not going to be able to access each other's honest perspectives, which means we're not going to be able to even understand our world at all. So enough of us need to have that capacity. Not everybody on every issue at every moment. No. But together, somehow, the web must be woven.
Yeah.
So it was painful with my parents. It was extremely hard. It continues, by the way. But what I saw was there are techniques. There is a skill. There is something here. I think it's easier than people think. Let me see what I can do to try to find out what these tools are and make them more accessible. And that's what led to the book.
So important. And I'm curious, my experience of all those years leading up to now, because we're at 9 years sort of in continued embedded sort of division, although it seems like people on the right are starting to actually move more central and people on the left had moved more. Well, they just became centrist because there was the options. Everything moved so quickly.
Yeah.
And then things flip, which I guess in history is what happens, which is wild. But my experience in that time as a Canadian experiencing the U.S., having my wife's American, was, of course, the shock, blah, blah, of Donald Trump getting voted in 2016. I was at a retreat and it was announced the next morning and people were just like, it was so unexpected. And I would say that the majority of people who go towards my work, but relational work, tend to be more progressive.
Yep.
So what was really interesting for me was through COVID especially too, was that I found that the labeling was really coming more from the left first. And it was the hard part, like it just would make my stomach sort of ill because I would feel so judged or that there was so much judgment. And yet it was marred in progressive conversations about diversity.
And
I was like, this is not congruent. Yeah. And my comment sections or my DMs were filled with far more vitriol from the left, that if I liked a post, or because I was very outspoken during COVID about the misinformation that was being peddled by the people in charge of information. And I found that a normal behavior that I'd always had, and I was in pharma for 14 years, so I had a background. I found that just normal information that I would question, and I think was a healthy response to be hesitant to take a product that would never on the market before. That's a healthy human response. Uh-huh. But that was being shamed. And I thought, am I crazy?
Yeah.
Or is this environment crazy? And what I saw was media leveraging on that very sensitive fear, which of course made sense during COVID, and the irresponsible use of fear, you know, by people in charge of sort of maintaining the health, public health, also people maintaining psychological health. Like I found that a lot of people in the mental health space were sort of the first to, because they tend to be more progressive. So I thought, this is interesting that the people in charge or tasked with maintaining our psychological health are also not having dialogue and conversations. They're firing clients for having different political views, like, which I get it. Like it's human. And I think if anything, our lack of capacity for difference has been so obviously labeled, but also our biases. You know, because I started to see how my own fears of not having space to dialogue about some stuff was making me dysregulated and making me participate in the same division that I was seemingly opposed to.
Yeah.
Was your experience as someone who was on the more progressive side, and I'm not pointing fingers, just that, did it seem like it started more from that side? And then now I see it on all.
Well, I guess it depends on what it means. I know, for example, I think of one term that captured a lot of this conversation for at least some time, which was cancel culture.
Yeah.
And that term, I think started squarely on the left. But, you know, these days people are talking about some of the same things happening on the right. And so I think it's important not, or it's important to question origin stories that put anything squarely on one side or the other. Because what I've found is, because I am a weirdo and I have, because of my work and because of it's wonderful for me, a lot of conversations with people who have very different points of view, I've learned that almost nothing is squarely on one side or the other, including what you were just talking about. So I can hear voices in my head going, but, what about this?
Mm-hmm.
So it's all human. You know, we want to have these boxes and these narratives because it's useful for a lot of reasons. But I will say that what I think is most important to do is not to try to figure out objectively, like, was it the right or was it the left?
Mm-hmm.
What is most important to do is to build your ability, any of us, build our ability to see flaws in our own side.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most important thing to do. Because in this divisive time, the temptation is, we are saints, they are devils.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So that's really it, is work on your ability to do that. Because we have a built-in resistance, you know, if we're on the left and we see that as a strong identity, and I often do, we have a built-in resistance to, this started on the left, you know, it was really you guys or whatever, especially if it's coming from the right, I my guard goes up. And we have to recognize that that's not what will happen if we hear something, you know, something different or something friendly or whatever. So it's mostly about that. Our brains are so geared toward belonging over everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another answer to your question earlier about why is it so important to start by getting curious within? Well, because these assumptions that bake into identity, they're like the goalie, you know, of our minds, what we'll believe and what we won't believe. And our goalie will just kick away everything that criticizes our side. And
smart.
That's, we have to be really careful. So, but like putting on my political, you know, analyst hat. Yeah, of course, you're right. I think that there was a lot of fear on the left for many years about harm coming to different communities. Jonathan Haidt, you mentioned his work earlier. His moral foundations theory is very compelling to me. And mm-hmm. He's done a lot of research that seems to point to folks on the left generally putting a whole lot of weight around this moral foundation of care and versus harm.
Mm-hmm.
And then folks on the left are very, 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 very square on that. So you bring COVID, you bring conversations about marginalized communities, you bring racial justice, you bring all these things to bear, and fear gets turned up really high. And when we're really afraid that we're going to mess up our world, we need to hold each other to better standards. We need to shame each other to better behavior. We'll do it. And we'll do it out of love. But it will twist. It will twist if we don't stay curious. And I will say, I saw a lot of incuriosity in that era. Yeah. From that group, but I see a lot of incuriosity from everybody.
I fully agree with that, and I appreciate the bringing back to the centrism of the core issue, which is that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where it starts, although it can help, like anything, like our childhood. Oh, well, that's where that thing comes from.
Mm-hmm.
We're still dealing with the material we're dealing with,
right?
And the reason I think it's important for people to be able to recognize their own ability to become evil, their ability to become close-minded, is because that's how history has continued to demonstrate that people think they're doing good things and they're willing to do really atrocious things.
Exactly.
And that's why I've felt I sort of see that the far right feels very much like overt narcissism and the far left feels like covert narcissism.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And so what I sort of see in those behavioral patterns is it's pretty obvious when you're dealing with an overt narcissist once you understand what they are and how they behave. Mm-hmm. But a covert narcissist is sneaky and it'll come out in like goodness and like taking care of you and for your protection. I think when we can even see that under the guise of goodness, we're capable of evil things, everybody is,
yes,
then now we can go,
yes,
But that's so confronting to identity.
It is. It is. No, but you've just named it. Under the guise of goodness, we're all capable of evil things. There's one of my favorite books of the last couple of years is called Falling Back in Love with Being Human. It's by a woman named Kai Cheng Tom. She's a trans activist, absolutely brilliant poet. And I can't recommend this book enough. And I interviewed her for my podcast. She's amazing. But the line that stuck with me was, a monster is what you're afraid to find in the mirror.
Mm.
All of us are so afraid to find that monster in ourselves. And so when we...
Amen.
We accuse each other of monstrousness, or we'll just call each other monsters. And everybody, you know, left and right generally have different ways that they do it. Mm-hmm. There's a thinker named Jonathan Rauch who says, and he's conservative and he's also very brilliant as well. And he says that he believes that the dominant emotion on the right is anger and the dominant emotion on the left is contempt.
Mm.
And contempt has this way of being a little, you mentioned sneaky, like, you know, sometimes the left, I think, plays the rules of civility on the surface, but the assumptions underneath can be quite vile.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I've seen. Like when I think of my conservative friends and you know, they walk around thinking, wow, like any blue space, any space that's coded blue thinks I'm a monster all the time. You know?
Which is pretty tough. Like the research looking at young college kids, they're more likely to hide their political view if they're conservative. Mm-hmm. They're also, what was really interesting in some of the data I saw on that is that students who identify as more progressive versus more conservative are less likely to want to share a dorm with someone with a different political view. Right. And I think what that just points to is the intolerance to difference. Yeah. Because you know, I have one of my really good friends, his mom, I was talking to her. She's from California. And at the time we were living in Idaho, and she said to me, "Ooh, that must be really tough." And I was like, "Why?" And she's like, "Well, you're just surrounded by so many Trumpers." Mm. And I was like, "Ugh, like I just hate, I can't." Mm. It would be like someone talking about someone again, you know, like California must be tough. You're surrounded by so many whatever.
Yeah. Biden-ers. And when people say that about Seattle all the time, oh my gosh, like some conservatives in other parts of the country.
For sure.
Seattle, how are you dealing with the fires and the riots? And I'm like,
right, right. Like you can't walk out, you can't stay out at night. You've got to eat vegan.
You know? My own parents were like, I just don't know how you feel safe. I'm like, what?
Well, it's interesting because like when she said that, I said, you know, I don't actually even know who anyone votes for around me. Like, I have no idea. I could probably make some assumptions. But, you know, lots of people from California and Seattle moved to Coeur d'Alene where I was. Mm. And so it was actually, I would say, quite diverse in thought. You know, it started to become much more diverse in thought. And I remember saying to her just like, what I hear is that it must be for me to hear what you're saying. I feel sad that you must miss out on actually really good connections and relationships because of the assumption you're making.
Yeah.
And I was like, because like, if I just assumed that you voted a certain way and then I didn't get curious about how wonderful a person you are.
Yeah.
And so what is the bridge back, Monica? Like what are these skills that we need to build because we need them now more than ever? We all need to bring these skills into our lives because our future depends on it. Our cultures depend on it. Our politics depend on it. You know, a big thing people feel is like, what's the point in even participating politically? It's all a racket.
Yep. Yep. Oh, I hear it. There's many levels of skills. I'll bring in some tactical ones.
Yeah.
One is we don't need to have the big conversation across the divide every time we talk with someone who doesn't see things the way we do. It can be a 2-minute exchange on a bus. It can be a question that you weren't going to ask, but decided to ask and got an answer. And then you just go back to what you were doing. In fact, the little interactions that can continue are often best because they intersperse with interactions that don't have to do with politics or heated things. And they build connection over time and they build resilience over time. Mm, so no true. Need to demand results, you know, of a certain kind from everything or to come in with like notes or anything like that. So that's one. Another, when you're in the conversation and you feel that confoundedness, what wants to come out of your mouth is, why do you believe that? why do you believe what you believe in that tone? And a really great technique is to replace that, you know, notice it, know where it's coming from in yourself, right? Like smile at that and then change the question to, how did you come to believe what you believe? One way or another, ask a question about story that pulls a story out of someone. What I've learned in my journalism career is that when I ask, how did you come to believe what you believe? I always get the details I need to tell a richer story that passes on that person's who they are, you know, better to somebody else. And it turns out to be really great in conversation too. You will get to the experiences that inform their opinions. And research has shown that when we share experiences, it leads to more effective understanding of each other's moral positions. Fascinating study on this. So that's another one. And then a third one I'll share is, you know, everybody talks about listening. We just gotta listen, you know, and it's become such a cliche. Okay, fine, I'll listen, like whatever. And we've talked for decades about what does it mean to listen? Well, you can't just wait your turn to speak and all of this. But I think that listening is about showing people they matter. That when you're coming together across a divide, even though everyone's got a smile on their face and they're kind of holding it together, sometimes there's just a lot of turmoil and a storm going on inside. Like, is this person going to take me seriously? Do they even care? You know, is this question that they asked with a smile on their face some kind of trick, or are they really? So people look for that from each other. And the best way to really build the engine of trust that's going to let you get to the point of talking about the hard things together is listen longer than you normally would, especially if you're like me and you're extroverted and you're kind of a first mover. I was the Hermione Granger in class, like throwing my hand up, like me, you know. I have had to really learn to give people space. Like, again, in journalism, it's like I had to learn to give people lots of space. So that means that they're saying something, I don't like it, in a disagreement, and I want to jump in and be like, but I got to hold that. And so my rule to myself is, if I'm really feeling that and it's a strong urge and I've got a but, you know, or as soon as they stop talking, like I'm coming in, I make myself ask one more question. And it's got to be a question of curiosity. It can't be but don't you think that blah, blah, blah? It's got to be not a don't, but a do. My friend Shira Hoffer taught me that one. Don't ask questions that start with don't you? Like, ask questions that start with do you? Those make you go a level more curious, you know, and put you a little more on their terms rather than trying to tug them into yours. These are things that really help us believe that we are actually receiving each other, which allows us to feel more open to even share each other at all.
Well, I love what you said about the bus too, like a bus conversation, because if they don't seemingly all end up in politics, you start to create disconfirming experiences of what you think about the world and people.
Yes.
And you realize, like, it doesn't, when you don't even talk about politics, you fall in love with people.
Yes. Yes. You know? And going back to the person you were talking about, you heard somebody say, oh man, it must be awful. You're surrounded by Trumpers, for example, right? Let's take that case for a minute. And it could be a libtard, you know, fill in your, like whatever
you
want.
I forgot about that. Wow,
there's
powerful.
Those too. Oh, there's a lot of them. I mean, whatever. We can have the label game. Yes, but you're taking somebody who believes that about a whole group of beliefs, or half the country, whatever. Honestly, if that person is just interacting with someone who holds that label for them and doesn't say a word about politics, it's still depolarizing. It's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Just presence in the knowledge that somebody holds a label that scares you. Just that. You don't even have to say a word. You don't have to talk about a single political issue. You don't have to bring up anything. Just the presence is healing. You know, decades of research into what's called contact theory have proven this out, that the best way to reduce stereotypes is for people to come into contact with each other. That's it. It's that simple.
Isn't
that amazing?
Yeah, and it shows you how before politics were ever actually even a human thing, you know, like when we were just tribes and we hung out, like that speaks to the biological nature. I think something I've been very interested in as of recent is how technology interacts with the nervous system and how none of us were designed to be able to hold so much information, much complexity. You know, we're so concerned about what's going on in the whole world, which I totally understand. I don't want to minimize that. And yet we are not active in our own families and our own communities. Right. Like that, start there and then, you know, get your own poop in a group before you go try, you know. But I think activism can also become addictive, you know, because for the identity that I'm here to change the world. And what I see a lot when I was talking about how the news can often be very, like we could feel righteous in the level of information that we're constantly watching and reading. And when I talk about finding a little more balance, don't watch the news, people will say, well, that's such a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, first off, having a phone would be considered a privilege, which is probably where you get your news. So is it a privilege to actually get the news, or is it a privilege to take care of yourself first so that you can be the most, you can have the most life force pouring through you to contribute to your family? And to, I just think we're so caught on our heels all the time and burnt out because our phones are literally designed to hook into this. To, as you said, you know, journalism knows this. If it bleeds, it leads. If it's extreme in its perspective, it's going to monetize your attention. It's going to keep you there. And I think one of the greatest forms of revolution now is actually deciding where your attention goes.
Because, that's absolutely right.
Right? Because then it leads to the conversation and the curiosity about self.
Yeah. If it's a radical act for me to be the agent of my own attention, so be it. If that's the counterculture,
Right. Bring on radicalism. Wow. That's a good,
right?
Putting down a phone, if that's the most radical thing we can do, which I think it is.
I completely agree. My friend Manu Meal, he's the CEO of an incredible organization called Bridge USA. Young people, chapters all across the country and college is amazing. Debates and oh my gosh, it's incredible. But he talks about conversation is the counterculture now. Right. In some spaces, if you kind of spend enough time, so it sort of starts to believe it starts to feel like kind of like you said at the start of our conversation, that what is strong is excluding people. What is strong is standing up for yourself and what you believe by making sure that you don't touch or you are not touched by any of these other vermin, that kind of thing. It's all right. If conversation is the counterculture, so be it. I don't think that we could possibly be capable of the kinds of things that we're going to need to do to become healthier as a society if we believe that it is our moral duty to stay glued to our screens and to the news. That serves the polarizers.
Mm-hmm.
That serves the conflict entrepreneurs. I'm not saying, look, I'm a journalist. Please stay informed. But stay informed in a way that balances with the rest of your life. Like as a journalist, I want people to be good citizens, good neighbors, good relatives, good friends, more than I want them to read every article I write. Because here's the thing, it's like, you know, I consider myself a responsible journalist, right? Like, but not everybody in media is out there trying to inform. A lot of people are out there just trying to get your eyeballs and trying to get you activated. So, you know, I can't sit here and kind of defend everyone who puts on the media hat as somebody that you should put your trust in all the time. Not to mention, like you said, our brains are not built for this. You know, everything I've learned about philosophy and spirituality tells me, be present.
Mm-hmm.
Be present in your life and with people around you. The phone pulls you away. Like, that's okay sometimes, but know your limits and be mindful because we will lose ourselves so quickly. And I've seen all kinds of folks, activists, non-activist, people are losing themselves. And we can't have that. You cannot make the world you want if you don't know, if you don't have a life that is that like you're not working on that baseline, that foundation, that support. So be aware if these things are giving you lots of dopamine, but are taking you away from your world, yourself, your stability, your health. That comes first. Privilege, no privilege. I don't care. That's what we got to do that. We got to hold each other. We got to take care of each other.
Well, I found it so interesting that the idea of choosing not to watch news was framed as privilege. Because then I'm like, oh, here we go using shame again as a mechanism. When it's really that I don't have the discernment to put down the news, so I'm going to shame you for having it.
Mm-hmm. Well, but let's steel man the argument, because that's just looking at it in one way, right? There's another way in which it's said it's a privilege to not have to read the news that comes from a place of, oh, if you don't feel that your livelihood is at stake by what's going on in the headlines, then you don't have to read the news because it's not going to affect you, but it affects me. And I think a lot of people say that statement from that place, which is a different conversation and a really good one. You know, I think that there's a lot of the most effective and genuine activists come from this sense of my experience puts me at more risk, at greater vulnerability with the results of whatever political stuff is going on. And there's a lot of folks for whom it's just a headline. And for me, it's my life, right? So that I get. That I totally get. But the whole point about the thing about yes, but stay steady still applies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when I think about even that, my perspective would go to, well, is the news the best place to find all that information anyways, as opposed to going and meeting with people you disagree with, you know, and protesting, etc. I'm curious, do you feel that or how do you feel about journalism and can people trust it anymore? Like in a lot of ways, like have you noticed any sort of decline or change in terms of if the sort of ethical duty of a journalist is to pursue truth? Is that a fair statement? I don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Do you feel journalism has abandoned that, like aspects of it?
I think for a lot of well-intentioned pursuit of truth, you know, kind of like we were saying, you know, out of love, some folks have ended up, you know, in behaviors that perpetuate a kind of dehumanizing hate. I think that happens in a lot of ways, in a lot of cycles through this very twisted time. And yeah, I think that there have been journalists who, through the pursuit of, you know, taking care of society as the fourth estate, have become incurious in certain corners towards certain people, and that has earned distrust. I think for a long time in journalism, the conversation was, people have just stopped trusting us. What's wrong with them? And that was the wrong conversation. It was more like, no, people have stopped trusting us. How did we deserve that?
What did we do to violate trust?
And what do we do differently? Right. And so to give credit to my fellow journalists, like that is a robust conversation that is happening. And it's beautiful. And just recently I've seen it flower. I've seen it bloom in ways that I haven't before. And I'm really encouraged by that. I think it's so important. It's extremely difficult. Talk about, you know, stressed out and emotionally activated. I mean, all these surveys for ages have talked about how journalists are among the most stressed out people in profession there is. I mean, we're all busy. We're all tired. And we have to read the news all the time. So we're going to be so more, blah, you know. So we have to take care of ourselves, which is really hard when you have 10 deadlines. So all of that, you know, it's like there's really good people working on this. But yeah, no, clearly journalists have lost a lot of trust. And the fact that they've lost trust in kind of a patterned way based on ideology and some other factors means that we have a lot of work to do. But journalists have always, even when they were kind of doing the things that lost trust in those ways, often it was because they were trying to gain trust with certain communities, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were trying to make better connections with, you know, along gender and race lines, for example, for a long time. And that was all great. What's so difficult with types and spectra of difference is it seems true to me that we can't put them all on stage at the same time. It's like you got to pick them, you know? There's ideological difference, socioeconomic difference, there's geographic difference, there's racial difference, there's gender difference, so sexuality. And it's like we can work on these two or three. But for some reason, we can't work on all of them. And I know the reason is because there's narratives that say that if you reach out to one community, just the act of reaching out to one community, another one is going to feel abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
The war between different communities, right? That this group hates that group. And so if you try to include them, then this other group that you're trying to, you know, it's been a storm
in
journalism. It's a trap.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And so I think journalists have been caught in that trap. Yeah. So I find that actually one of the questions that is most provocative to me is at a time when engaging one perspective is going to feel like you're abandoning or threatening another perspective, how do you solve that?
Yeah, I think naming it like you're doing. That even exists, that the fact that, as you were talking about before, engagement's not endorsement, that if I could count the amount of times at the height of cancel culture that I got a DM that said, oh, I saw you liked this post, I'm unfollowing you, or please explain yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm like, get fucked. Like, this is the world you think you live in, that you get to just like come shame me because I engaged with the post.
Yeah.
And that,
yeah,
I see as a journalist, I mean, I can only imagine how delicate, because as humans, especially when the cultural landscape is saying curiosity is actually the abandonment of, like, if you're even curious about nuance, that mm-hmm. means that's dangerous. Curiosity is dangerous.
Right.
And I can feel like culturally that's shifting.
Yeah.
Like with anything, though, we swing too far first.
Exactly.
You know?
We do. And I do see possibilities where curiosity would be dangerous, right? Like an outright 100%. War. Again, if the bear is chasing you and you're going, no, we just stop and talk to the bear, you're going to get everyone killed. And I recognize that. So much is also another provocative question is, where exactly are we along that spectrum of
well, who decides?
And who decides?
Because I thought a conversation with a Trumper to one person could be dangerous. A conversation with a libtard to another person could be perceived as dangerous.
Oh, yeah. And is. Know? Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's right. It's like, where is the line and who gets to decide? Because what I noticed in sort of the 2020 to 2023-ish time, sort of at the height of this, is that the people who had the lowest capacity for difference were the ones dictating what we could talk about.
Yeah.
And really so what ends up happening is we end up pivoting around the people who have the least exactly. ability to dialogue.
Exactly.
And it's like, well, that's how we end up in these echo chambers.
Yeah.
And of course, short form content, you know, is.
Yeah. Yeah. And not to mention, I mean, the subtle mechanic that social media created was the idea that I can see your entire social network. You know, before social media, you have no idea how many people, you know, I associate with or who and what they're like. But now people can go and read it and scrutinize it and judge it and judge you totally. By it. And so now that ethic has spilled out into our real life, you know? But these things were never visible before. And mm-hmm. now they've become one more tool for shaming and blaming and trying to present what? Something we think others will approve of. Because again, belonging is such a beautiful concept. Everybody loves it. Everybody elevates it. All these organizations are like, we want everyone to belong. And it's great, but we have to acknowledge the dark side of belonging. That when you put that first, you can put like a lot of things second that ought to sometimes take their turn up at the top. We are so afraid of being abandoned. We are so afraid of being judged. We're so afraid of losing support. And, you know, we didn't even get to the loneliness epidemic. Jeez. So right. Yeah, perfect storm, like you said.
Yeah, and we'll just end up more in those isolated spaces if we don't reach out to people again. It's what's very clear is that echo chambers do not resolve mental health challenges.
No.
Just perpetuate them. And
they do. But again, let's steel man that, right? I mean, echo chambers. Okay. When I have known people who have been so afraid and they need people who are afraid in the same ways.
Mm-hmm.
To feel okay for a while. They need people who understand, who they don't have to explain themselves to. People who share that fear understand instantly. And that's like, it's empowering. It takes us out of the darkest holes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we lean on each other that way. And then we don't have the capacity to challenge any of the narratives that brought us together. And that's where we get into trouble. But I can't blame people for, yeah, like you said, explain yourself, explain your fear. People don't want to explain their fear. They want their fear to be seen. And because they can't function right now, they're really scared. And, you know, we criticized the left a little bit this conversation. We didn't make a ton of room to criticize the right. There's a lot that people are very afraid of, that I'm afraid of.
That makes sense. It makes there are legitimate concerns of all of the far right ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
Obvious, you know, mm-hmm. I think are pretty obvious,
mm-hmm.
you know. For anyone who's holding any sort of centrist space of curiosity.
Yeah.
And I think other than the people trapped in those, because I think most people who are even identify as more conservative and maybe voted conservative, I think they can even name and label those things.
Oh, yeah. No, and they can. They can.
Yeah.
I've had lots of those conversations. Like nobody, no side is saintly and no side is pure devil either. I mean, we've all got the good and the bad in us and we have different flavors of it. And the more incapable we are of seeing our own sides, flaws, that's the thing that's really going to bury us. We have to be able to do that. But again, the more afraid we are, the more that we're going to need that sort of locking in of your friend like me, good. Let's
hold on to each other.
It's a trauma bond.
Yeah.
And so too many trauma bonds on both sides are going to result in complete blindness to our, you know, one's own side's flaws, which just allows the worst stuff to happen. And that's what we got to work on. I think we have to work on that more than let's bring the other side down, no matter what they're doing. We've got to work on that capacity everywhere, really, really, really hard.
That's so beautiful. I think the idea where we also started with was, you know, what happens if we do platform a different voice? Like actually actively seeking to platform different perspectives. You know, I have a friend who was debating on a subject, and I said, let's just go have coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, you know, we're texting each other. Like, let's go sit down and have a coffee and actually get curious about each other's perspectives. And then there was a lightness to the conversation.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
Oh, it's so much heavier on text. It is so much heavier
text
on text.
Text is the worst.
Ugh. And then you don't know where the other person is. It's all asynchronous, you know. Like sometimes I'm texting with someone and it gets kind of serious, but I'm having an argument with someone else at the same time. So there's an irritation that's coming into this conversation that doesn't belong there. But there it is. And then not to mention, if somebody is like looking at their text from somebody else and they suspect that other person is like, I don't know, kind of like not saying the whole thing, or they're feeling suspicious of that other person, you're going to read those words on your phone in the voice you're giving the other person, not the voice they actually had when they wrote them. And what voice are you imagining? Well, it depends on your mood and how you're doing. And the other person can't calibrate to that because they're not with you.
Amen.
This is not a good way to have arguments. Pick up the phone.
The nervous system is not designed for that. It's designed to co-regulate. That's why dinner tables matter.
Yes, yes. Battlestar Galactica, one of my favorite science fiction series. I don't know. There's moments, and I'm realizing it could be a spoiler, but let's just say that sometimes I just want to throw all the technology into the sun.
I agree with that. You know, I've been really deep down the rabbit hole of technology. That's been a big thing for me, especially social media. And one thing that I found that I really love that feels so good, like engaging with it, is, have you ever seen the Daylight computer?
No, what's that?
So it's an amber screen.
Ah.
And here, I'll show you. It's an amber screen.
Yeah.
And it has zero flicker. And so you don't get tired reading it. It's very soft on the eyes.
Yeah.
And you can watch YouTube on it. It's not addictive because it doesn't have a plethora of colors. And so it's really harmonious with your biology.
I'm looking at that. That's really cool. Okay. Christmas list.
Yeah. The origins of that company are really, really cool. And so I've been really thinking, okay, well, technology isn't bad.
Huh.
And technology can be bad.
Yeah,
right?
It can.
So I think when we start to really decide our relationship to social media and our attention, then what naturally comes forward is, how do I engage with my phone, and how is my phone changing my relationships? Because one thing I've consistently seen as true is that the last thing we tend to touch at night is now our phone.
Yeah.
And that has such a detrimental impact on our relationships. Mm-hmm. Also, picking up your phone in front of your kid can be really impactful.
Oh, yeah. No, I've learned that. I was a deep, deep phone addict for a while, and then I had children, and the distance was too much.
I get it. You know, I think of like my son, look at me, say something, and I'm looking at a phone. It's like the still face experiment all over again.
Yep. We have a rule in our family of four that when somebody, it's usually the parents, picks up a phone, you have to say what you're doing on it.
Oh, that's cool.
You have to interrupt whatever's happening. I'm answering a text from your uncle.
Oh, that's smart.
That's helped us a lot.
Yeah, because then it's like, well, I don't really need to be doing this. There's like a level of responsibility in the transparency.
Yes, and the kid gets to hear, you know, why are they doing that? Is it important?
Yeah.
Like, are they just looking something up? Are they bored by what I'm saying? Do they not listen to me? You know?
So important. And all that will change how a child engages with difference in the world.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, yeah.
Ugh. This is amazing, the work that you do. I'm so grateful that we got to have this conversation, and I just want to applaud you for the courageous natures that it takes to confront, you know, curiosity, you know, in the face of your own parents having a different perspective, but how this has led to you writing a book that people need. We need it. And so thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for this conversation. I loved it. I loved it. We went so many interesting places, and it's always the best when I find new things as a result of conversations with new people. So I've done that today. Thank you.
Well, I found so many new things, and I'm for everyone listening, where can they find more of you?
So moniguzman.com, MoniGuzman, and Moni Guzman on Instagram, and moniguzman.com, you can sign up for my newsletter.
Fantastic. And your book is available everywhere that books are sold.
Oh, yes. Yes. I never thought of it that way. There's an audiobook. There's, you know, the indie bookstores. You can go for Amazon, whatever you'd like. It's all out there. And yeah, check it out. And I'm very, very easy to find. Let me know what you thought of it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Monica.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
When you're going through a breakup, it feels like your whole world is unraveling. And the hardest part isn't just the loss of the relationship, of course. It's the loss of the story you thought you were living, the story you thought you were going to create. But I want you to know this. Heartbreak doesn't have to be the end. It can actually be the beginning. It is the beginning if you let it be. And that's why I created the Breakup Recovery audio series. It's a 5-day journey to help you move through heartbreak with compassion, clarity, and strength. For just $30, you'll get guided audio teachings, powerful stories, daily activities, and a full reflection workbook to work through alongside me. This isn't about bypassing your pain. That's BS. It's about giving you the tools to process it, learn from it, and emerge more grounded in who you truly are. And finally, putting an end to the patterns in relationship that you keep finding yourself in. So if you're ready to start healing, head to createthelove.com/breakupaudio and begin today for just $30. Because heartbreak doesn't define you, your recovery does.